Romans 10. We're still in Lesson 10, which we started last time in Romans 9. But Romans chapter 10, as Paul continues to deal with this question, and one that's really painful for him, the question of what happens to the Jews. They were God's chosen people. They haven't accepted Jesus as Messiah. So what happens to them? If they were the chosen people, and really part of this with his audience is, if they were the chosen people and God rejected them because they didn't follow God and they rejected God, then what would keep God from rejecting the Christian church if it rejected God or didn't do what it was supposed to do? Obviously not all the Jews had rejected God, but they hadn't accepted Jesus as Messiah. And that's kind of where he gets into things today. Last time we talked about the affection he had for Israel and how he described that, and how Israel's history demonstrated that God did fulfill his promises in spite of the fact that Israel didn't think. Okay. Okay, Cope's at Anderson. Okay, thank you. Thank you. And by the way, Sarah's been moved to, instead of 7:30 tomorrow morning, to show up in the procedure at 9:30 at 7 and 9. So Sarah's cryosurgery in the morning. She's over at her house. She will be at St. Francis outpatient. Sarah Allen, Ken's, yes, in Greenville, St. Francis outpatient. Now, you run into Greenville Memorial, but you get off and go around and end up. You can get on 120. Yeah. You can get on 123 and get there. 123 runs right into the back of St. Francis. But it's day surgery. Yeah, but it's outpatient surgery. Yeah. She will be at the downtown, on the back side, the outpatient surgery side. No, she won't be staying. She's outpatient. But, so that is tomorrow. Isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't want to belabor this too long, but you know those things that these tests that you supposedly take, and they tell you, this is best for you, or you're this kind of person, or that. I was bored this afternoon, so I took one that's supposed to tell you left brain or right brain, and I'm 66% left brain and 34% right brain. So, what that means is I'm more logical and rational is left brain, and right brain is more imaginative and creative. Well, our son David, you found a bumper sticker one time, and because he's left-handed and left-footed, and it says only left-handed people are the only ones in their right mind. Because the right side controls the left. Paul probably would have been more left brain with rationality and that kind of thing than he would have been right brain with imaginative. As he deals here with a difficult question of how one comes to God and what the Jews, how they ended up rejecting God, what's the only way, and that is by faith. Now, to understand chapter 10, though, we really, I think, need to begin with chapter 9, verses 30 to 33. What shall we say, then? That Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained it, that is, righteousness through faith. But Israel, who pursued the righteousness which is based on law, did not succeed in fulfilling the law. Why? Because they did not pursue it through faith, but as if it were based on works. They've stumbled over the stumbling stone, as it is written, Behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone that will make men stumble, a rock that will make them fall, and he who believes in him will not be put to shame. Thank you. So here, we really need to start there. That was a note telling me Copes and Anderson, but I didn't want to say. I already know. But here he gets to beginning this most painful part of his argument, though, and really raises questions about all of that. He seeks to show how God both contracted made Israel smaller, but then also expanded Israel. Now that may seem kind of odd, but the contraction part, the contracting of Israel, is God sends Jesus as Messiah and Israel rejects him. Therefore, Israel, that is, the people of God, and he's not using it Israel as in ethnicity here. He's using Israel as the people of God. Israel, as the people of God, shrinks because they don't accept Jesus as Messiah. But then Israel, as the people of God, expands because now the Gentiles who accept him then become known as the people of God, or the new Israel. Matthew uses, and Paul will at one point describe them later as the new Israel as well. And so he says, so what should we say? This is not rhetorical. He said, Gentiles who didn't seek after righteousness came to God by faith in Jesus. Israel pursued righteousness, that is, the righteous law, thinking that they could work their way there. In fact, a more literal translation would be seeking a righteousness based on the law. So they looked at legal observance as the way that one became the people of God and became recipients of God's grace, which then would cut out Gentiles unless, like the Judaizers wanted them to do in some of the places, Galatia and others, unless they first converted to Judaism, received circumcision, did the sacrifices, kept the law, and then they could become Christian. In fact, in Galatians, Paul will say, you have fallen away from grace. Why? You've fallen away from the grace God gave you because you're making circumcision and law and Moses more important than, or the first step before you can become Christian. And so that's the warning here. It's not that Israel didn't lack faith and belief in God. They did have faith and belief in God throughout their history. But they failed to respond in faith to what the new thing that God was doing in Jesus. And that's this reference here. They did not pursue it through faith, but works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone or the stumbling block. And then, as it is written in verse 33 here, of chapter 9, he is quoting Isaiah, where in Isaiah we find in 28 and 8 both that the Messiah is called, God says, I put a stumbling block, that they'll stumble over it. And so what he's really saying here is that if one doesn't come in belief and act in belief, showing faith in God's action in Jesus, then you have rejected God. Therefore, since you've rejected God, potentially you're rejected. Potentially. Because Paul always held out the hope that eventually Israel could still come back. As long as you were still alive, you still had the opportunity to come back. Jesus then is the stone, which is a symbol of God's presence and God's help. But by neglecting it, the stone has become an instrument of judgment. Jesus didn't come to judge. In fact, in John 3:17 says, the Son did not come to judge the world, but that through him the world might be saved. The judgment comes by rejecting the one who came as the stone, the presence of God's help. And the stone in the Old Testament oftentimes represented the strong presence of God. Then he moves then to chapter 10 to talk of true righteousness by faith. And notice here, brethren, or brothers and sisters, it's actually the Greek word is brothers. My heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. Why do you think he called them brothers or brethren? You got the brethren and the sister. Why did he do that? he's talking both to Jewish and Gentiles here. He didn't separate them. Cindy, he didn't separate them. And he calls them brothers to reiterate the fact that, you know, he said, I'm not scolding you just because I'm mad. I'm scolding you because you're my brothers. You're still my brethren, and I'm hurting for you. So Paul's not here jumping on because he's angry because he hates them. Rather, he's hurting for them. He's scared for them. He feels badly for them, and so he calls them brothers to try and say, listen, you're still my brothers, but now you need to listen up and come to God in Christ. Now, what do we find here? What's the content of his prayer? What does he wish for them? I mean, he shows this deep, genuine concern, but he says, my heart's desire and my prayer. My heart's desire and my prayer is what? The end of verse 1. That they may be saved. That's right. That the Jews might be saved. That's his deep desire here. He knows Gentiles are coming. But see, Paul was raised a Jew. Paul was trained a Pharisee. Paul still believes that God has a purpose for the Jews, but they've got to recognize this. And he said, so my heartfelt desire, we might say. Have you ever had a heartfelt desire like that for somebody? Whether it's a salvation or something else, it's really important. You ever had that yearning, deep down where it hurts you to think, maybe even brought tears to your eyes, to think about they might not get what they really need if they don't listen. Especially when it comes to redemption. But it can be other things too. Yes. Oh, the televangelist, you know, that say, you know, send your money and get this and that.
The Jewish people weren't going to go to heaven because they had to accept Christ as Savior. I mean, all
right.
Is that right?
Right. Well, if you go with what the New Testament says, and you know, there's only one name under heaven by which you may be saved, you know, that they need to, you know, to make that decision, and that's where Paul really is here, and he's holding out the hope that as long as they're alive, they still have the opportunity to come. And even though he was primarily the missionary to the Gentiles, you know where he set up every time? In a town? He'd either speak in a synagogue or he'd set up right on a street corner outside the synagogue and preach really loudly and debate really loudly, hoping he really wanted to draw Jews out of the synagogue to take him on so he could convince them that they needed, yeah, they were God's people, but what they had not been, was not fulfilled for them. They needed to accept Jesus to do that.
Then he holds up this book and he says, send me something. And something like Jewish people can't be saved. He says, send me the money for the book.
Right. Well, that's just like the guy in Hendersonville years ago who, you know, for $25 you can get a vial of Jordan water from the Jordan River, same water Jesus was baptized in, you know. That's probably in the Arctic somewhere, frozen now. But here, you know, he wants salvation. And for him here, salvation means to be gathered into the people of God. Salvation is to be gathered into the people of God. Not just to keep you from burning, but to be gathered into the people of God, who then are supposed to live in such a way that other people want to come and be part of the people of God. Right.
I'll get to him for that. Yeah. But it still comes down to one-on-one. As in one will be chosen, one will not, and everybody else.
You've got the individuality there, and in the New Testament, it's redemption is individual, but you're still part of the corporate body. In fact, within the New Testament, you cannot truly live as Christian if you separate yourself from the body. You cannot truly live as Christian if you separate yourself from the body. The church, the nation, or the church. But in Judaism, Of course, individuals make up the nation, but the nation was the important thing. The nation would be saved. Oh, yes. And, you know, you got Jews for Jesus. You got Messianic Jews who follow Jesus, that kind of thing. But, what he wants, yes, there is the individual, but it's not so much this one's going to be chosen and that one's not, as in I'm chosen because I choose to accept, not because God said, well, you're going to get it, but you're not. And that's what Paul's saying here, too, is, he offers it to everybody, and it's not a national thing. It's not an ethnic thing. They talk about being sons of Abraham. Jesus said, well, God could raise up sons of Abraham from these rocks. It's not just your ethnicity. You have to make the decision to follow and to do. And yet, a part of that, in the New Testament, throughout, and even Jesus will say that, if you separate yourself, if you can't really be his follower, if you separate yourself from a church, from others who are his followers. Writer of Hebrews,
Right.
Well, that's only God knows for sure. But the New Testament points more towards if they reject reject the stone, the cornerstone, then they're rejecting God, therefore they're rejecting the grace that they would get. But see, Paul, and in chapter 10 here, Paul will say that Jesus, they did know about Jesus. They knew that about the Messiah all the way back in the Torah. He's going to do a couple of interesting things with passage out of Deuteronomy and with a passage out of Isaiah to show that the Messiah was already preached and predicted in the law. And then Isaiah preached even more so, therefore they really have no excuse because it's already there and it's already been there, and he will pull that into here. He said, fellow Jews, he wants them to be gathered into the people of God that God is now forming based on faith. Not on law. It's based on faith. But then again, Abraham was called the friend of God, and he was before the law. His relationship with God and his redemption and his salvation was based on faith, not law. And so what he's trying to say to them as well is, look, even Moses was accepted and accepted God before the law came along. So if they can be accepted, and accepted it on faith, then guess what? You can too, because it was already presented before the law. So his prayer here, to be saved, verse 2, I bear them witness they have a zeal for God, but it is not enlightened. And so he's praying that this zeal that they have, they're very zealous, that commitment that they have to God, will be enlightened. He said they've committed to God, but they don't recognize. This word for enlightenment here also means to recognize or to acknowledge. Gnosis, to acknowledge. So what happens, and I guess really part of the questioning here is, do we find ourselves, these are some of Israel's shortcomings, how often do we find ourselves with the same kinds of shortcomings? We have a zeal for God, but we're not enlightened. That is, we don't recognize or acknowledge. And part of that is acknowledgement has to do with coming to gain more knowledge, but then acknowledging or recognizing that God is in the midst of gaining that knowledge, and this is what God has given us in Jesus, and to recognize and acknowledge God in Him. There's a difference in knowing there is a God and acknowledging God and His claims. There's a difference in knowing, even the idolaters in chapter 128. It's the same word he uses here. The idolaters in 128 who do not see fit to acknowledge God, it's the same word he uses here when they're unenlightened. You don't recognize Him or don't recognize what God is doing. As Luke Timothy Johnson writes, when God chose to gift humans in a new and unexpected fashion through a crucified Messiah, those who were zealous for the Torah would not recognize and acknowledge God's action in Jesus. End of quote. Part of that also has to do, quite frankly, with them being so locked into the law and their understanding of it that to have a Messiah crucified, the law says, cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree. And so in their estimation, since Jesus was crucified, he couldn't be God's Messiah. Rather, he had been rejected by God and he was cursed because he was allowed to be hung on a tree. So instead of coming to recognize more fully that that was God's means of Jesus becoming the curse for us so that we didn't have to bear that curse. Yes. That gives power to the crucifixion, not resurrection. And so, you know, they said, you know, they would see that in the law as, oh, he couldn't be Messiah. God's not with him, because if God were, God wouldn't have allowed him to be hung on a tree, crucified. And yet Paul will say, ah, but he was preached. Even in the law, the Messiah was preached. And then Isaiah comes along again. But how often do we do those things? For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Are the times that we try to do it on our own? Paul? Peter was crucified on a cross. Paul, there are different traditions about how Paul died, but typically that he was beheaded. But Peter was crucified on a cross, but he said that he was not worthy to be crucified the same way as his master, so he asked to be crucified upside down. So Simon Peter was crucified upside down. Because he said, I'm not worthy to die in the same manner. But here, I mean, are there shortcomings that we have? Are there times that we are ignorant of the righteousness of God because we try to do it our own way? That's one of the questions that we've got here. It's one of the questions we got here. You know, before we start totally condemning the Jews or somebody else.
All the Jews that died before Jesus came.
Mm-hmm. Except for Moses and Abraham and the ones that came before the law, yes.
But now the ones that still don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah, or if they still live by the law,
they're living under the curse of the law.
Does that?
But Paul would argue, because the law was there then, and Paul would argue, and I think he would argue to us today, that they are under that because they cannot be righteous enough, therefore they're not righteous in God's sight. But if they really understand the law, that it points toward the coming of Messiah, and that the prophets point toward the coming of Messiah, then there's, as long as they're alive, there's hope.
Well, but they still believe that it's still coming, though.
Some do and some don't.
Well, already...
Yeah. Orthodox, for the most part, believe there will be a Messiah. Most conservatives, there will be a Messiah. Reformed Jews know there's never going to be a Messiah. Right, right, yeah.
What about the Jews that died before Jesus walked that step that living by the law, and they're going to be in heaven?
They're judged according to how well they lived the law.
The ones now that still don't believe Jesus came, they're still waiting on the side, and they're still living by the law. That's what I...
No one can keep all the law and be justified by the law. Yeah, and Paul teaches, the New Testament teaches that, you know, Jesus, well, in fact, here, verse 4, for Christ is the end of the law, the telos, the end of the law, that everyone who has faith may be justified. By end here, it doesn't mean that he ends the law. There is no more law. What did Jesus say in the Sermon on the Mount? Till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot, not one tittle, not one iota subscript. There were some letters that had a little iota subscript under them. That gave extra meaning. Well, from the law will pass away. Okay? So the law still has a purpose, but not the purpose of redemption. It's a purpose of giving a goal of living. Jesus as the end of the law, because he said, think not that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them, which means not just to be the fulfillment. He came to be the fulfillment of all that was prophesied about him in the law, but at the same time, he came to the word to fulfill there means to explain the full significance. He said, I'm coming to help you understand the full significance, the intent of the law, not just the letter of the law. The heart of the law, not just the letter of the law.
But
I would think so. But what he's saying here is Jesus as the telos, teleology, the end of the law, is that Jesus isn't ending the law. Jesus is the goal or the intent of the law. The goal of the law was to bring people to Messiah. He is the intent of the law. He's the goal of the law. He is the final peg in the hole for the law to get people to God. So the word telos or telos here means goal, terminal, as in terminal end. You know, you get a terminal degree, that's the last one you can get, right? If you get a terminal degree, a doctorate, that's the last one you get. It's a terminal. It's called a terminal degree. In other words, you've worked all the way as far as you can go. Well, what he's saying here is Jesus is the final terminal. He's the end, the goal toward which the law is pointing and working. And so there is nothing else beyond that that gets you to God. It is Jesus. He would not be welcomed in the local synagogue. Yeah, someone thought John the Baptist was the Messiah. And actually, there were some people who suggested there were some people who suggested that Judas, also known as Maccabeus, in the book of Maccabees, first and second Maccabees. First Maccabees is pretty good historical writing. Second, third, and fourth get more spurious as you get out there. But there were folks that thought Judas Maccabeus, or Judas the Hammer, was maybe Messiah because they were thinking of an earthly political ruler. And when Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, the Seleucid king that was trying to get rid of everything Jewish and sacrificed a pig on the altar in Jerusalem, which is probably the abomination of desolation mentioned in the book of Daniel. When that happened, you know, he tried to get rid of all these Hasidic priests, and one guy, Mattathias, in the town of Modane, refused, and his sons, the oldest one was Judas, fought back and led the Maccabean revolt, eventually defeating Antiochus Epiphanes' forces and recapturing Jerusalem and cleansing the temple and setting up Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights. There were people who thought, because he was so zealous for God and doing this for God, and God was with him in doing that, and the way he fought, it was almost like he was a very good guerrilla fighter, not apes but guerrilla fighter. He was so good at that there were people who thought this is almost like David again. And so there were people that actually thought Judas Maccabeus might be Messiah. Of course, then he's assassinated in a plot with some Seleucids that he let live and one of his brothers so that his brother could take over. And then he was assassinated. Right. I've been in a couple of meetings where those discussions have taken place, and it can get rather tense and contentious. No, it's a whole Torah, including all the covenant codes, all the covenant codes that were given, all the other laws that come about in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and other places as well. Well, if you were to. Well, I mean, you know, there are laws, for example, if you were to go to Leviticus, laws concerning worship, who can worship when and who can't, and who can be priests, those kinds of things. Well, but then you've got in Exodus 21, these are the ordinances set for when you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and the seventh shall go out free for nothing. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out She shall not go out as the male slaves do if she does not please her master who is designated. Those kinds of things. Whoever strikes a man so he dies shall be put. Yeah, Ed? Yeah. Ed? Yeah, Ed, whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death, but if he did not lie in wait for him, God let him fall into his hands, then I'll appoint for you a place to which he may flee, which was sanctuary cities. I tell folks sometimes, people who want to go back and go by the law again, strictly by the law, whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. There'd be a whole lot. There wouldn't be as many teenagers around.
That still comes under the Ten Commandments one way or another. It's like we were talking in the Sunday school lesson this morning. Jesus summarized the Ten Commandments with love your father, with love thy father God with all your heart, mind, soul, and desire. But in other words, the number one.
Yeah, the greatest commandments are love and your neighbor. Yeah, and both of those come out of the law.
Yeah, and if you do that is going to one way or another cover everything, because if you do this certain love, you're not going to kill, you're not going to
right. Deuteronomy 6 and Leviticus 19,
yeah,
where those come from.
And that virtually bundles it down by doing this deeply right here. You're going to, on the side, do everything else anyway.
In other words, you're saying the Ten Commandments should come back to us as well.
Yeah.
Well, it was a general guideline for living. And what happens then later is there are more specifics. And in Exodus 34, after they've wandered around for a few chapters, after God gets angry because of the golden calf, in Exodus 34, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments come back in, but there are things added to them as well. For example, when it's, you shall not make a graven image, it also goes on to say you shall not kindle a fire on the Sabbath. Because to kindle a fire, you have to have a fire to melt the metal to make a graven image. So things get added to it, more specifics then. And so he goes on to say, well, what's the difference between righteousness based on the law and righteousness based on faith? Verses 5 to 13. He talks about Moses writes, a man who practices righteousness by which is based on the law shall live by it. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down? Who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead? What does it say? The word is near you, on your lips and in your heart, that is the word of faith which we preach. Because if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For man believes in his heart and so is justified, confesses with his lips and so is saved. The scripture says no one who believes in him will be put to shame, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all and bestows his riches upon all who call upon him. For everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. What's really interesting here is he actually uses, if anybody wants to read it, I was going to, but we're running short on time. But Deuteronomy 30, 12 to 14 in the Septuagint. Paul doesn't use the Hebrew scripture. He uses the Greek translation, the Septuagint of that. And he changes it slightly. Wow. We'll go ahead and read it. It is not in heaven above, as if one were saying, who shall go up for us into heaven and take it for us, and we will hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea, saying, who will go over for us to the other side of the sea and take it for us and make it audible to us, and we will do it. The word is very near you, in your mouth, in your heart, in your hands, to do it. Okay? He says here, the word is near you, on your lips, in your heart. That is the word of faith which we preach, because if you confess. Doesn't say anything about the hand. So he alters it slightly, and he alters it to the point to where he says, the word we preach, whereas this is talking about, in Deuteronomy, the law. In Deuteronomy, it's talking about the law that God gave. And Paul says, well, that law actually is the word that we preach about Christ. So he's altering it in his understanding, his interpretation to these Jews and Gentiles here is, you don't have to go into heaven to find it. Christ came down here to you. You don't have to go down into the abyss, which would be the depths of the sea, because Christ has been here with you. Therefore, the Word, that is the law, then, is near you, It is on your lips and in your heart, parentheses, that is the word, which the word of faith which we preach. And then verse 9, because if you believe in your heart and confess Jesus is Messiah and God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved. So what he says is this law really was talking about the Word, as in beginning was the Word. The divine Logos was Jesus. And therefore, guess what, folks? He's saying to his fellow Jews, you can't argue that you were ignorant. It was here all along. You just didn't pick up on it. That's why you're not enlightened. You didn't pick up on it. So now you need to become enlightened and acknowledge that. He'll also, over later in the chapter, quote from Isaiah. Here in verses 16 and following. But Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? He says, so faith comes from what is heard. What is heard comes from the preaching, what? Of Christ. And so, according to Paul, they've got no excuse because it was already there. And they, of all people, should recognize when God comes in the Messiah, in Jesus, because it's already been there. He says, you know, there's no need to search heaven because Jesus came to us, no need to go to the depths because Jesus was raised from the dead and was here. He says, you need to, he reads back into the Torah, the promise of Christ, and shows that Jesus was pre-promised through the prophets. Jesus then is the Word that has come to us. This Word of the law. And by following Him, He replaces the commandment with the Messiah, Christ Himself, and by following Him and confessing Him, then we are saved. Deuteronomy in the Septuagint says, the Word is very near you, in your mouth, in your heart, and in your hands to do it. Paul is interpreting the confession, public confession, and not just once, but ongoing public confession, that is, living it daily, as in your hands to do it. The Word is in your hands to do it. And so he says, Jews and Gentiles have all of that in common. God came in Jesus. God gives us that Word, and that Word not only it begins in the heart, but it continues with the social action of public confession. Public confession not only when you stand up and confess that Jesus is Lord, public confession when you're baptized, public confession when you go to work the next day and you live it out. And the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that. So it's not just showing up once and getting dunked, poured, or sprinkled. It's a daily kind of thing. And that's where salvation comes, a combination of the heart and the mouth, a combination of the internal and the public. And said, when we do that, God will acknowledge and honor us. We will not be put to shame, no matter what somebody else may say or think about us. And in verses 14 and following, he deals with Israel's rejection of the Word. How are men to call upon Him in whom they've not believed? He's setting up a series of questions. Somebody said, well, wait a minute, we didn't hear. How are we to call upon Him if we hadn't been told? And how are they to believe in Him of whom they've never heard? How are they to hear without a preacher? You know, this generally around time of ordaining ministers or ordaining deacons is where you get this stuff, right? And how can men preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach good news. But they've not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah said, Lord, who's believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from what is heard. What is heard comes by the preaching. And he said, there have been prophets preaching all along. But he says, the preaching of Christ, that is, about Christ. Paul would contend that they had heard, but they failed to believe. They failed to understand. They failed to acknowledge those things. Hearing and believing the gospel were foremost in his mind here. Faith, saving faith, comes from what is heard, what is preached, and what then is lived. That's where saving faith is. It's not just to hear it and to confess it once, but it's what's lived. That's saving faith. And he says, Israel did not understand. Other nations heard and understood. God reached out continually. Israel rejected. And anyone who rejects, as Israel did, is outside of salvation. That doesn't mean they're outside forever, but they're outside of it until they die. If they're outside of it when they die, then they're outside of it forever. Of course, chapter 11 is kind of interesting. I ask then, has God rejected His people? By no means. By no means. But, you know, and he says, I'm a descendant of Abraham, an Israelite, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected His people whom He foreknew. But, he goes on, do you not know, you know, that God hadn't rejected you. You've rejected God. Throughout chapter 11, he said, God has not rejected you. God continues. So, for us, God continues to tell us the good news in Jesus, who is the end of the law. But, saving faith involves not just once or twice, or you feel backslidden and so you come back again, or you go get tossed down in one of these big mass baptisms in swimming pools somewhere for the third or the fourth or the fifth time. Saving faith comes in living that belief, accepting it, and then confessing it daily. That's saving faith. That is what we have been called to. The old covenant is not replaced by Jesus. The old covenant is fulfilled in Jesus. And that's what Paul's saying here. Jesus didn't come and say, well, we're going to toss all this out and here's something I'm going to replace it with. He said, it's been there all along and it was God's intention all along. Jesus is the fulfillment and the completion of that covenant. Oh, Jesus? Yeah.
And he says, it's better to heal someone on the Sabbath than not heal them.
Why? Because God does good.
Yeah.
And God wants good, and God does good on the Sabbath. And I'll be kind of halfway facetious here. If you go read in Genesis, beginning of Genesis chapter 2, you know, you got God creating in 6 days, right? 6 periods of creation. And Genesis 1, and it goes to 1:1 to 2:4a. Chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them, and on the seventh day God finished His work which He had done. He rested on the seventh day from all His work which He had done. I kind of halfway facetiously said, oh, it sounds like He tied up a few loose ends at the beginning of the seventh day. But the point is that even if that is the case, God was doing good in the creation. And Sabbath, while Sabbath rest is rest from normal labors, Sabbath is not meant to keep us from doing good.
And you get into the new world that we're in, now you've got to have national defense. So forth and so on. So somebody's got the light and fire and the mess all built up together. I mean, I know you can't justify, okay, it's okay because we're in the 21st century now, things like this, but things have freed us so that we have to hold up their mandate that we do. And it is doing good, you know, to take care of your nation.
Well, and what, you know, God never intended for the Sabbath to be, the law says, you know, you're not to pick a fight on the Sabbath and start a fight on the Sabbath. What the Maccabees did, what the Maccabees did, was convince the people because Antiochus Epiphanes sent in after, Mattathias and his five sons killed the emissary and most of the soldiers he sent to force them to bow down to Zeus and to Antiochus Epiphanes. When word got back to him, you know, they went to the hills because they figured he'd come after them. And they were right. And so they figured if they went to the hills, he'd come looking for them. They weren't there. His soldiers leave the village alone and go looking for them in the mountains. They were right that he'd come after them. They were wrong about the other. In fact, they showed up on the Sabbath knowing that the Jews in Modane would not fight. And they slaughtered over 1,000 men, women, and children because they knew they wouldn't fight. And so they come back and say, wait a minute, hold on, time out. No, you're not supposed to pick a fight on the Sabbath, but God doesn't intend for you to stand by and be slaughtered just for the heck of it. You can defend yourself from that which would kill you. Yeah. You don't start it, but you can finish it if you need to in order to preserve. Well, it was very relaxed, yeah. Yeah. But and so that really raises a question then. How do we acknowledge God? How do we live the righteousness of God each day? What can we learn from what Paul says about Israel and how they reject it that will help us? If under the law, the way they had it set up, if, of course, Jesus said, do any good. I mean, the blind man, the lame man, they weren't going to die. But under the law, you were forbidden. You could save someone. You could do whatever was necessary to save someone if their life was in danger. But if their life wasn't in danger, you couldn't. If you're walking through, going by the law, and you're walking through a cow pasture on the Sabbath, and you're just watching where you're stepping and walking through and enjoying, looking at these nice, fat, sleek cows, and all of a sudden there's a bull, and that bull doesn't like the fact you're there, and you didn't pay, and you hear something, and whoa, here comes the bull, and so you start running. Well, lo and behold, Ed happened to be walking along. He sees you running. He gets over there to the barbed wire fence. Hey, come on. Come on, Roger, hurry up. He's gaining on you. He's gaining on you. And just before you get there, that bull hooks you with a horn, breaks your legs, breaks your arm, and slings you into the barbed wire, and you're hanging there. Now, no. And then, you know, and Ed's sitting there watching, and he notices the bull's making another pass, and he's going to kill you with this one. So what Ed does, well, let's see, okay, flips a coin. It starts rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling, and he follows it. And, okay, it comes out heads, save you. He could do that because you were going to die. So he rips you out of the barbed wire fence and throws you down to the ground. He's, thank you, Ed. You saved my life. I'm glad I could do it, Roger. Hope you can get to the doctor. Hope you can get to the doctor tomorrow. And Ed goes on. Why? Because he just saved your life, but he couldn't do anything more than save your life. Yeah. So Roger, that's how the law worked with the Sabbath. You know, you could save, if someone's life was in danger, you could save their life, but you could not do anything else but instantly to help because they could see the doctor the next day. So, you got ripped out of the barbed wire, you got a broken leg and a broken arm, but they're not going to kill you by the next morning. So, and Ed is not allowed to carry a burden on the Sabbath, so he can't pick you up and carry you anywhere. So that's kind of how the law played out. And so that does raise the question, though, how do we live out that righteousness? Do we try to do it by works of the law, or do we live it out? And yes, we may do works, but it's not because we're trying to do those to fulfill the law. It's because we're in response to the righteousness of God and the faith and the grace and the mercy that God has given. In other words, we're living out that faith on a daily basis. We're confessing on a daily basis that we are Christ's. And that's really the crux of the question. Back then, a Jewish doctor, if it didn't mean your life, and in Orthodox Judaism today, living by the law, strictly by the law, no. If your doctor is Jewish, he's an Orthodox Jew, and you got the flu, he's not going to write you a prescription for Tamiflu. Why? Because you can wait till tomorrow to come see him, if it's Sabbath. Otherwise, he's breaking the law. Thank y'all. We'll pick up in chapter 12, which is lesson 11. Chapter 12 next time.